On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If doing for others is the road to happiness, New York's Wesley Autry, who jumped onto subway tracks to save a man's life last week, ought to be the happiest guy on the planet these days. But what about the rest of us? A new science of happiness is attempting to pin down what really lifts the spirit, to measure it and to teach it. Happier people live longer. They get fewer colds. They have better relationships and do more for others. Since the time of the ancients, we've had advice on the good life. Now, after a century of measuring well-being by the march of economic indicators, psychologists are saying, let's measure and teach well-being itself. Up next on Point, teaching happiness. Joining me first today from Washington is D.T. Max. He's a science writer for the New York Times Magazine. His article yesterday was Happiness 101. D.T. Max, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How's your mood today? Feeling happy?
Well, if there'd been less traffic, I'd probably feel a little bit happier.
Hey, you got the story published, so be happy for that. Take us into what's going on here. Campuses across the country with classes on happiness, it's now the stuff of science. Is that right? What's really being taught here?
I think what's being taught is a possibility of making yourself a happier person than you are ordinarily. I think we should be clear right at the outset. It's the idea here, or the possibility here, isn't that you're going to be able to take yourself from a miserable person to an ecstatic person through these fairly easy steps. But essentially, what's going on and what's new is that a group of professors of psychology believe that they are able to teach you in a fairly easy way, scientifically verifiable steps to make your life fuller, make your health better, essentially by making you happier. And the way that I first got interested in this, I think this is sort of illustrative, is I think we've all noticed that people who that some people who are enduring incredible difficulties are not necessarily more miserable than those who would seem to be enjoying very luxurious situations. Mm-hmm. I was working on a book called The Family That Couldn't Sleep, and it was about a family that had what many people considered the worst disease in the world, which is a fatal progressive insomnia, and yet these people were not miserable. They had an incredible resilience to them. And they lived their lives much as we do. So I began to think to myself, well, Is there some kind of a disconnect between our circumstances and our moods? And then I came upon this science, which I consider actually not a bad science at all for a new science, called positive psychology.
Give us a sense of how widespread the interest in this is now among academics and among students. What's going on?
I think that it's pretty widespread, and I think essentially, what they're offering is a fairly simple way to have a better life, a fuller life. Like you said in the introduction, this has been a concern people have had from the beginning. It's an ethics concern, and it's also a psychology concern. But, finally, it's a very human concern. So students seem to really, really love these courses. And I think the ultimate goal of positive psychology is to get students younger, to get them at the high school level. My article is primarily about teaching college students, the basics of positive psychology. But I think what ultimately the positive psychologists dream of is that you have positive psychology worked into the high school curriculum in this country without even really knowing it.
These classes, very popular. The 800, 900 classes for a positive psychology class at Harvard, in Chapel Hill, University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, you write, people really pouring into these things. Why now? Are students unhappy? Are they less happy than before? Or is it just because the scientists have picked them up and they're there?
Well, I can only theorize on that. It seems to me that students go through an incredible process now to get into college, not at all like the process when I was applying to college. They come in stressed and they come in exhausted. They come in a sense, ready to be repaired. And then here's this class that promises a kind of repair. I'd say in addition that part of what positive psychology is doing is it's picking up on something that nobody else is currently doing in the culture, which is teaching not just pleasure, but engagement. So, for instance, you sit down in a class with a professor, and the professor says to you, the way to be happier and healthier is to do good. Well, that's a lesson that you might have gotten in church in another era. It's a lesson you might have gotten from your parents in another era. but now you get it from these individuals, and students are really responding. The Harvard class was the largest class on campus. And people go, well, you know, it was a gut. Okay, there is some truth to that. You know, it was an easy class compared to, say, taking Introduction to Economics. But at the same time, I think 23% of the students said it had significantly improved their lives.
And so they sign up in big numbers lately. D.T. Max, stand by there. We can hear with you in Washington, and we're delighted to have him, Todd Kashtan. He teaches psychology at George Mason University, including a popular course there on the scientific pursuit of happiness. He's director of the Laboratory for the Study of Social Anxiety, Character Strengths, and Related Phenomena, specializes in curiosity and well-being. Professor Kashtan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate it.
I can feel, people want to be happy, but then there's a natural skepticism about teaching it. I mean, humans have taught and thought about happiness for as long as we have any record. Go back to the ancient Greeks. What have you really got that's new here to say?
Well, that's a good question, and I want to add some of the insights to DT, which is really this course isn't designed with the aim of trying to make students happier. Really what it's about is no different than any other sort of domain of science, where we're really talking about what we've learned with rigorous scientific tools about the nature of these positive experiences, these positive traits, how to cultivate these experiences, which people are more likely to be happy, what makes them different, what makes them sort of susceptible to positive states, and a second component of these courses. So that's sort of what differentiates it from thousands of years of philosophical traditions that sort of relate to these concepts. The second piece, which is what makes it so exciting as a course, is an experiential component of how can they apply these skills that they're learning in terms of what's being conducted and replicated in the laboratory and actually apply it to their lives to see, is there some level of disconnect or does it resonate with them?
So the how-to part here, the experience, but take us first to what you say has been learned, i.e., you know, what's new? What do we understand about happiness now that wasn't understood 5,000 years ago or even 30?
Well, there's a lot of things. One is that we're examining at different levels of analysis. And what I mean by that is we're examining at the neurological level, sort of genetic chromosomes that make us more or less resilient to stress or traumatic events. We're examining sort of what particular behaviors or what particular events on a given day will make it more or less likely that you won't just experience a sense of meaning or pleasure on a given day, but what makes it able to sustain itself at a high level over the course of time? Because it's really easy to induce positive emotions, make someone feel good. It's a lot more difficult to try and create a high level and then sustain it over the course of time. And these are the things that I think we've really are starting to get a grasp on.
Give us a sense of the kind of research that's gone into that and the kind of really sharp, clear, new insight that we've got about happiness today that we might not have had earlier.
Sure. Well, you know what? I'll self-promote and talk about one of my own studies that's currently underway, which is really examining maybe one of the ways to living a meaningful life is not by meditating, being serene and satisfied, but maybe by challenging yourself, thriving on novel new experiences. And what I've found in my research, so for 21 consecutive days, we had college students report what happened to them on that day, what they do, what they feel, what sort of satisfaction they get. And what we were interested in is what predicts days that are particularly meaningful compared to days that are pretty much somewhat apathetic or lethargic. What we found is that people who are particularly curious and tend to explore their worlds end up having a lot of experiences on a given day where they're actually expanding themselves, looking to learn new things, expose themselves to unfamiliar people. And because of that, they're reporting a higher sense of meaning on a given day. And it also lasts from one day to the next.
So climb another mountain, plunge into a new setting. D.T. Max, you've been looking at a lot of this, and there's this explosion of research here on happiness, optimism, positive emotions, healthy character traits. Are you persuaded, D.T.? Do you see a sort of new profile of what makes happiness emerging, or is it essentially what they said in the days of yore?
I think that the answer would come out somewhere in between. It's a new endeavor. It's a new discipline. The science is pretty young. And when you dig a little bit deeper, there isn't always a huge body of research there. For instance, some areas of it are kind of well documented. One, optimism. One of the sort of tenets of positive psychology is kind of learning to be more optimistic and learning not to sort of assume that anything that bad happens to you for personal reasons or is going to happen to you again. For instance, I was stuck in traffic this morning. So positive psychology would say, well, it was a bad day for traffic. Whereas, you know, I might, as a born pessimist, say, you know, I always choose the wrong road.
Right.
Okay. So they've actually got good science to show you that, you know, in effect, if you teach yourself to be more optimistic, you will derive numerous benefits from it. That's great. Okay, so I'm on board for that. Mm. As they get more into the world of engagement and faith, which is a part of positive psychology that I found a little bit complicated to deal with as
faith,
a
as in
science.
Religious faith, DT?
Well, they never use the word religion, but religiosity is used, mm-hmm, spirituality, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Engagement, connection. I mean, few people are against these things in the abstract, but when I would ask, you know, sort of, well, what's the science behind this? You know, people go, well, it's coming, you know, and that's okay. And I'm not saying that negates this as an endeavor or as something that college students or high school students should be. But I think one has to be aware that, you know, that this is not, we're not talking about cognitive psychology. We're not talking about something that has, you know, decades of research behind it. I mean, I say give them a chance, but acknowledge that reality.
We've been joined by D.T. Max. He had the story in yesterday's New York Times magazine, Happiness 101. Todd Kashtan joins us. He teaches psychology at George Mason University. They're with us from Washington. Right now with us is Frank Newport. He's editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll. They've been looking very recently at Americans' state level of happiness. Frank, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So what's the polling find, Mr. Gallup poll? Are Americans happy?
They are. They're particularly happy or personally satisfied when we compare to questions asking, are you happy or satisfied with how things are going across the country? That's what we think is one of the major distinctions. You know, just 30% of Americans are satisfied with how things are going in the country. We get a lot of depressed data back when we ask about the administration and foreign policy and all of that. But when we focus in, are you personally satisfied, the numbers jump way up to between 80 and 90%. And when we say, are you happy, a big percent of Americans, 90% or so, will say that they are at least very or fairly happy. And those numbers are fairly constant over time. So in our view at Gallup, at least based on those two measures, there are other measures, but on those two, it's fairly constant that despite the vagaries of what's going on in the world, most Americans say, oh, yeah, I'm okay.
It is remarkable. So country to hell in a handbasket, personally doing fine, thank you.
That's right, and we find that, by the way, in a lot of other measures you're probably familiar with. How's Congress? Doing a terrible job. How's your congressperson? Oh, I like my representative.
Right.
Healthcare, big crisis. I have a good doctor. Education, terrible across the U.S., schools my kids go to, great. So in a lot of instances, people, when they focus, or when pollsters make them focus on their own lives, are much more positive than when pollsters ask them about things, quote, out there.
And Frank, what about connections to their circumstances? Did you see trends between who's happy and who's, I don't know, rich, poor, middle class, you name it?
Yes, we do. Money can buy happiness to some degree. People who report they are very happy almost double as income goes up. If you're below $30,000 in our latest survey, just 36% said they were very happy, and that jumps up to 63% if you're in the highest income group that we look at, which is $75,000 or more. So there is a correlation, a zero-order correlation between income and happiness. There's some other things going on there. Older people, for example, tend to have lower incomes and some other correlations that kind of interfere with the basic relationship. But everything else being equal, if somebody makes more money, they're happier.
Todd Kashtan, what do you make of these Gallup poll results? I've seen all kinds of survey material now on happiness. And I have to say, some of these don't line up with other reports that I'm looking at. You deal in this all the time, Todd. What do you hear in what Gallup is showing? What do you see in the surveys on youth, wealth, age, and how they associate with happiness?
Well, the polls that Gallup are using are making an incredible contribution because they're having such a huge sampling of the population. There's some reason to be a little bit skeptic because they tend to be a one time point, and so we do know that sort of your mood. Sort of at that moment when you're completing that survey will have an effect on sort of what your answers are.
But if you drop in on a big number of Americans, even just for one moment, and 80 or 90% say they're happy, gee, it looks like everything's coming up roses here.
Well, what's interesting is we have these built-in biases that we have. So let me take an example from what we know. It's called this peak end effect, and it's based on Daniel Kahneman's work. And the idea is we make general assumptions about event. Let's take colonoscopies. Not that pleasant. Not really a good place for positive psychology.
Okay.
Two people have a colonoscopy. One has a moderately unpleasant colonoscopy that sort of lasts for 25 minutes. Another person has a colonoscopy that lasts for 5 minutes, but the last 30 seconds are exquisitely painful.
you've got me way off in an unhappy zone here. Where are you going with this?
Well, it's an interesting thing. It's because when people evaluate the colonoscopy, which overall is not a pleasant procedure, sort of people will rate the one with the really intense negative ending as being particularly unpleasant, undesirable.
Gallup poll says 80 to 90% of Americans are happy. Why do we need your course if that's the case?
Well, the thing is that it's in terms of when they make these general evaluations, when you break it down to what domains are they satisfied with and sort of what areas do they feel that sort of are they living incongruent with things that are important with them? When you break the data down a little bit further, you find that as income has increased over the past 3 or 4 decades, there's been almost no change in terms of a sense of meaning and purpose in people's lives. And that's an interesting disconnect between the two. So it shows that sort of even though we're gaining more things, that we derive some immediate level of pleasure and gratification, in terms of sustainable high levels of meaning and well-being in our lives, there's not that much evidence to support that.
Frank Newport at Gallup, how do you read these numbers? I mean, you deal with lots of people just in your personal life. Do you find Americans in your everyday life 80 to 90% happy, or is there something about being asked that makes us say, oh, yeah, I'm happy, thanks?
Well, I think there are certainly a lot of subtleties beneath the data. It's kind of like our job approval rating on President Bush. That's a summary measure, but if you get into specifics, you find a lot of variation. Some people like him, No Child Left Behind, but hate his policies in Iraq. But we force them to come up with one basic summary, and that's what we do with these happiness numbers. But what's interesting to me, I think, is that we've been tracking these going all the way back to 1948 in one way or the other, and we just don't find a lot of change. That just when you take a cross-section of Americans, regardless of what they may be doing when we call them and ask them how happy are you, we find most will either say very or fairly happy. Relatively few will put themselves into the not very happy category year after year after year.
So decade upon decade of responding to the Gallup poll, Frank Newport, editor-in-chief there, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
D.T. Max, what do you make of that steady state? The country gets richer, but it doesn't get happier. On the other hand, Gallup, you know, has a real high thumbs-up response there from the people it talks to.
I think that just speaking now as somebody who sort of looked at positive psychology, it would be consistent with their goals. And the reason I say that is that positive psychology was specifically founded in 1998 by a group of psychologists who believed that we focus too much on negativity, on trauma, and on syndromes and so on. And basically their founding idea was that we lived in a time of peace and prosperity when psychology should begin to look not just at are we happy, but how can we be made happier? In other words, the needle is in the positive territory. Now, how can I push it further to the positive territory? So I don't think that for positive psychologists, Frank's data would be troubling. I think on the contrary, it would kind of reaffirm that they were sort of, you know, the old Willie Sutton line about, you know, why did he rob banks? Well, you know, because that's where the money was. So by the same token, positive psychologists, you know, are dealing with happiness because, well, as it turns out, most people are happy. So if you deal with trauma, you kind of ghettoize yourself into 10% of the population. I'm speaking roughly here. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything beyond Frank's numbers. There may be some nuances there. But you ghettoize yourself in 10% of the population, whereas, well, if you look at happiness, you've got 90% of the people. You're dealing with really, you know, not just the extremely rich. You're dealing essentially with a cross-section of the population. You could do a lot more good.
Open the classroom doors, and in come the students. They want to learn about it. Let's hear from our listeners. D.T. and Todd Kashtan, stand by. Andrea's calling from Easton, Massachusetts. Andrea, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering, I'm a faculty member at Salem State College. I teach voice lessons. It's actually more on a one-to-one basis as opposed to a classroom. I teach high school students at a performing arts center, and I found that in both cases, the mood and sort of their situation with their current relationship, whether it's new or they're exploring that territory, has directly affected their work ethic and the quality of the work that they're able to perform.
You mean the romantic relationship?
Yes. And I think in both cases they're exploring those areas maybe for the first time or, you know, in what they feel is a very serious way. And I find that oftentimes to get them into the actual physical part of their voice lesson, I sometimes spend 10 to 15 minutes talking first to get them
right
to a place where they can actually work.
And when romance is high, so is their performance. But then, isn't that kind of as old, Andre, as, you know, I've often walked down this street before, but the pavement never rose to meet my feet before? I mean, don't we know that? Do you see room for...
You know, I think actually it sometimes impedes their work, depending on their sense of confusion over it. So I find that obviously a good mood or a positive place in which they come to the lesson, that obviously brings a better result in terms of that actual lesson. So I'm actually wondering whether the classes or the courses that are described involve maybe a work and explanation and psychological information concerning how a relationship, good or bad, affects school.
Let's look at it, Professor Kashtan. How about it? Relationships here, from romantic right on through family and friendship. What correlations are you finding? Is the field finding with happiness?
This is where the action is. To answer Andrea's question, these sort of courses are not therapeutic. So there's no sort of intervention discussing how this sort of affects people's work. What we do know is that if you had to pick one thing that sort of distinguishes extremely happy people from even just somewhat happy people, it's the quality of their relationships. And to go back to your point that you keep on making is, well, what new things have we really gained since sort of ancient time? Well, the thing is we're learning about exactly are the boundaries of what a good relationship will do for you. And this didn't exist until we developed the methodologies to do this. Let me give you an example. Sheldon Cohen, sort of at Carnegie Mellon, he basically injected a bunch of college students with some viruses. And what he found was...
You mean true pathological viruses? This is cold and flu viruses, I think I read.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. I couldn't get away with this with George Mason. The IRB would have me under arrest immediately and quarantined. And what the question was who's going to actually develop a cold?
Okay.
In the course. And what he found was that those college students who were more lonely or had a less secure, who had a less stable social network of people they can count on and call on to talk to, spend time with, romantic relationship or friends, these people were much more susceptible and actually developed viruses. So yes, we know social relationships are good. Good romance, good sex, these are good things. But what we're now finding is it actually affects you at this biological level in terms of whether or not when you walk out in the rain on a wintry day, if you're a lonely person, you are more likely to catch a cold or pneumonia than the person next to you who has a good relationship and a partner they're going home to.
So keep that happiness high if you can. Let's go to Nashville and Corey. Hi, Corey. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling. I read an article. This was a number of years back in the New York Times about happiness. And it said that happy people tend to believe that happiness is their doing. And thus they tend to go out into the world believing that anyone can have it if they just apply themselves.
Yep.
And it sort of blinds us to the fact that there are lots of structural factors in our society, our class, our wealth, our connections, our race, which contribute to what we deem as happiness, and that it really can make us callous towards others, thinking that, well, they're just not applying themselves. They don't want to be happy because they don't have the things that I have.
So watch out for kind of danger, kind of hubris of happiness there. I'm happy, so good luck to you.
Right.
Todd Kashtan, how about it? You're describing relationships as pumping it up, but once people have it, does it make them kind of inured to the unhappiness or suffering of others?
No, this is an interesting misconception. The idea that, for example, people who are really optimistic, they're not attentive to they have sort of their rose-colored glasses, they've got their blinders on, and they're not attending to the negative things. So really, they're living this life of deception. Actually, there's a lot of research to show that Not only is it not true, but actually optimistic people are incredibly good at persisting at extremely challenging tasks and seeking information in troubling situations, such as when they're diagnosed with cancer or they realize that they have cancer in their family and they're predisposed to it. optimistic people are the ones who are more likely to go out and seek out preventive care, seek out information on the internet. So a lot of the sort of preconceived notions of being happy sort of makes you less cognizant or less...
empathetic, maybe.
Right, or less aware of the negative mm-hmm. things that are going on in the world. The data don't show that. But the caller brings up a really good point, is that there are boundary conditions. If you happen to be in an environment that's sort of not allowing you to express yourself openly and be authentic, this is going to interfere with your ability to feel a sense of competence and feel a sense that you have the control to actually make decisions. It's self-determined on your own, and you're not feeling these pressures to do the things that make you do the things you do.
DT,
so there's boundary conditions.
Yeah, DT, as you looked at this, where were you feeling the sort of balance of personal versus social in this new focus on positive or renewed focus on positive psychology? I mean, did it look like, just kind of personal buffing one's personal happiness, or did it look like a part of a fabric of social well-being when people focus on happiness?
I think that the teachers, that the instructors would like the whole thing to be one bundle where personal happiness leads to happy schools, leads to happy societies. As I looked at the science, I found that the science for personal happiness was actually sort of the strongest science they had. For instance, part of positive psychology is kind of implicitly antagonistic to Freudian psychoanalysis. And one thing that they found to their delight was that they have something called a gratitude exercise, which means if at night you write down three good things that happened to you during the day, and apparently it has some connection to positive well-being and health. And then as a kind of control group, they had people write down at night just three things from their childhood, which would be a classic Freudian mm-hmm. exercise and excavation as a kind of control group. And they found that, in fact, writing down three things at night that had happened to you as a child had absolutely no effect on your well-being. Okay, so point one for them. Personal happiness, science, we can see it. As you move out into the world of ethics and the idea that, we'll form happy societies, happy schools, happy corporations, there I found that there was probably less science than rhetoric, probably more enthusiasm for what one day might prove to be true. And I do think one other thing that the caller is mentioning that's worth bringing out is that I did always feel a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that there was a particular way to achieve health. Let's say, okay, you have relationships, this will give you health. But, some people aren't very good at relationships. A positive psychologist would say, there are a lot of different signature strengths, as they call them, a lot of different ways to succeed in the world. Yet they would keep coming back to certain of these things, optimism, relationships, so on. These are, kind of tried and true ideas for how to be happy and healthier, but they have now some hard information.
DT Max is with us. He wrote this up in the New York Times Sunday Magazine yesterday. Todd Kashtan's here. He teaches psychology at George Mason University, including a course on the scientific pursuit of happiness. Right now from Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, Caroline Keating joins us. She's a professor of psychology as well, does research on leadership and social relationships and charisma. Caroline Keating, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
So you're in the field. What do you think of this new big emphasis push on the science of happiness? Are you buying it?
Oh, well, I have to say I feel some pressure to say that I'm happy to be here and
right.
join you with some comments. I think there are a couple of caveats that I'm sure Todd would agree with, and this is not to say I wouldn't love to take his course, but a lot of the research that supports positive psychology is correlational at best, and that's risky stuff because we don't know the direction of causation.
Explain what you mean by that, Carol.
To some degree, income is related to happiness or reports of happiness. On the other hand, the correlation isn't all that high, and it's actually one's perception of one's income that better predicts whether or not you have life satisfaction. So in other words, a lot of happiness is in the eye of the beholder, and I'm sure Todd would agree with that. But what we don't know is how important that eye actually is. So it's difficult to say what is cause and what is effect. It's possible, for example, that happy people make more money.
And what about teaching happiness, Caroline? I mean, is happiness defined the same way by all people and all cultures at all times, or are we teaching a particular stripe of happiness when we get into positive psychology courses today?
Yeah, here the devil is in the details. If you study cross-cultural psychology, it's obvious that there does seem to be overall in the fabric of human experience, this need to belong. But woven into the fabric are tremendous cross-cultural differences. And I think one of the most interesting things, and really a bugaboo for positive psychology, is this. One thing we know about Western societies that are very individualistic, like ours, that is, societies that emphasize the individual experience and individual identity over group identity.
Yeah.
One thing we know about those societies is that personal individual happiness has a very high merit, has very high value in our societies. So we would define happiness, perhaps, and most likely, as personal happiness. Others in other cultures, which are more collectivistic, would say that happiness derives from giving the group good. So the good of the group is more important than personal happiness.
Todd Kashtan, how do you think about that? Is it uniquely American happiness that you're focusing on here, that you're researching and teaching, or are there universals?
No, Carolyn's points are right on cue. All of her criticisms are perfectly appropriate and apropos to the research. That being said, pos psychology is not sort of a unified entity. Really, this is no different than any other field of psychology. The methodologies are the same. They're just as rigorous. The process of sort of producing it is the same. Really, the only difference is the target. And so there is a lot of correlational research. And the Gallup poll is one of those examples which would fall under the criticisms that Carolyn's making. The cross-cultural findings are really very interesting.
But we've got a cross-cultural country. Does that mean you can teach happiness, or does it mean you're teaching a particular stripe type when you set out to do that?
Absolutely, you can. I mean, one thing that you don't want to do is you want to recognize of what makes certain people more likely to pursue, to derive benefits from being grateful, to derive benefits from being kind, to derive benefits from spending 8 hours a day reading or just working, that derive more benefits from work as opposed to leisure. And we do find cross-cultural differences there. But when you get to the basic fundamental aspects of what Carolyn's talking about, which is we do have this insatiable need to sort of feel a sense of belonging, to feel that we're competent and that we can actively, effectively do things and master things. These are things that are pretty universal. But the thing is that we find that in some cultures, it's more or less easy to obtain those. In collectivist cultures, it's easier to satisfy that need to belong. Because of the fact that sort of the structure of communities is that people actually know their neighbors.
But what does that mean? Are the Japanese happier on balance than people in other countries? I spent a lot of time living in Japan, actually. I didn't find it a euphoric place. Or is that just an American view?
Well, it's also about the display of emotions. Is that in other cultures, you know, you don't wear your excitement and zest and enthusiasm on your sleeve, which is what you see in Asian cultures. If you look at sort of the Gallup polls, the U.S. ends up about 13 in terms of as a society, in terms of our average well-being. Now, then a really interesting finding is when you look at the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies.
Okay.
You look at the Maasai tribe in Africa. So they basically have their homes made out of dung.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of they're basically living in poverty.
Play. Yeah.
Right. And if you go there, and you spend time with them, or if you just look at sort of their response to a simple question, circling which face reflects, happy face reflects, how happy you are, the average well-being in the Maasai tribes is almost virtually identical to the happiness, the well-being levels of the CEOs of the Fortune 500.
So give it all up.
There's something to be said about that.
Give it all up for the plains of Kenya. And never mind the cash. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let me go to Buffalo, New York. Marie's on the line. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm afraid my second point has already been answered, but I would like to make a first point, which is the lack of happiness may be perceived here as a failure. And we live in a culture that abhors failure. So I imagine that very few people would readily admit to being unhappy.
When you say here, Marie, do you mean the United States?
In the United States, we are a sense of failure is really difficult to tolerate. So
everybody's supposed to be a winner. Winners are supposed to be happy.
I believe so. I don't know if it's a valid point, but it just comes to mind because very few people would admit to failure here.
It's a great point, Marie. Let us pick it up. Caroline, how about it?
Yeah,
do we say we're happy because we're supposed to be happy winners?
We're supposed to be. There are codes that suggest that we need to look happy, and you know that's particularly true of women. If you look at smiling in women, women and girls smile more than men do. I don't think it's because they're happier, but they do smile more because it seems to be the expectation for women that they smile and they are perceived then as happy. And that's a very strong pressure on people. There's a lot of pressure in an individualistic society like ours to express personal happiness and to be happy. And meanwhile, the negative emotions probably play a very important role in our everyday psychology. And one worry about positive psychology is that we may be squeezing the full range of human emotions over to the positive side, and that might be a terrific mistake.
What about the prescriptive part of this, Caroline, if I may? I'm looking here at, this stuff is everywhere now. Here's Time Magazine just coming out. And here's a list of 8 steps toward a more satisfying life coming out of your field now. This is from University of California. You know, as Todd was saying, count your blessings, practice acts of kindness, savor life's joys, thank a mentor, learn to forgive, invest time in family and friends, take care of your body, develop strategies for coping with stress and hardship. On the one hand, these sound timeless. On the other hand, they're now coming out of academic circles. So, do you see these as new prescriptions? Aren't they obvious in a way?
Well, yeah, well, some of them are quite well rehearsed, but they are effective. And even though the long-term data are a little sketchy, I mean, they go out maybe, I don't know what, Todd, maybe 6 months in many of the studies or something
at
like
most,
that.
Right.
Those kinds of self-help ideas can be useful. However, you know, it's also useful to be able to deal with the downside of emotions. You know, there's at least one group of researchers who feel that depressive states, you know, being depressed is actually a goal-directed adaptive behavior that reduces sort of your risk in social interactions. When you're not feeling up and you're not feeling good, you kind of stay away from people until you are feeling better. So we can't leave those emotions out either.
DT, what about the correlation? Speaking of correlations, the correlations between Frank Newport at Gallup was saying, you know, people's assessment of how the country's doing, not so great. Happiness, better. So is there some kind of opiate going on here? I mean, maybe we shouldn't be too happy. Maybe when the polar bears are floating away on ice cubes and we've got a war in our hands, maybe too much happiness is an avoidance attitude.
I think that's entirely possible, Tom. I think one thing that you know, whenever one looks at a science like psychology, it has a huge self-reported aspect to it, which means, you know, and this, I think, part of what all the different participants have been talking about for the last 10 minutes, including the callers. It's, well, you say you're happy. Are you saying you're happy because, you know, there's a kind of competition, a happiness competition in the States? And I certainly think there is. Or, you know, are you genuinely happy? Or, you know, do you simply not know what happiness is? You know, I think that this kind of question is not going to be answered in the short term because, you know, I actually believe that self-reporting is a fairly effective, let's say, soft science tool. Self-reporting, you know, how happy are you, Tom?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm happy today. Okay, mm-hmm. But I don't run any tests on you, and I don't test the happiness chemicals in your blood, and I don't plug you into an fMRI to, you know, see what your brain is telling me. So I think we should always kind of proceed with caution. On the other hand, it actually over time is fairly, you know, it's fairly consistent what people will say about themselves. Anyone, you know, people have personalities. I think personality is a big part of all of this discussion. And those personalities, I think, can be truly, truly conveyed through self-reporting.
Todd Kashtan, there used to be talk of a set point in terms of individuals'
right.
happiness, that I'd be a person would be given to a certain range of happiness. What's the view on that today? Do we come kind of with a built-in, natural point in the spectrum where we live? Can that be changed?
There's no question that, genetics and heritability play a huge role in terms of, you just have to look around your office and look around your family at the next family gathering. You've got a bunch of curmudgeons, you've got a bunch of people that are like 8-year-old kids on a Toys R Us shopping spree, and you've got everything in between. When people have genetic temperamental differences in how they express their emotions and their the ease in which they're able to feel positive emotions and extract positive emotions from a movie, an intimate conversation, an amazing dinner. You know, just to come back to some of the points that are being raised, is there's a little bit of an oversimplification here of sort of how we study happiness. You know, Carolyn's right attuned onto the criticism of if we ask people how they're happy, we're going to find people that are going to try and present themselves in a favorable light, and we're going to find people that are genuinely happy. What we do is we don't end at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, then we ask ourselves, well, how do we differentiate these two people, two sets of people? They're both saying they're happy. One's genuinely, one's deceptive here. We look at what do we expect people to look like if they're happy. We expect them to be able to concentrate easier. We expect people to be reactive when someone tells a joke or they see something humorous or they're in a bookstore and they sort of gravitate towards things that interest them.
So you're not depending on their self-description entirely.
We're combining or triangulating a series of measures together to get at a composite. And we're not simply relying on self-reports. But once we do these sort of studies, we recognize that these self-reports tend to be somewhat useful as a nice starting point.
Science getting its calipers around our happiness. Let me get a call from Nick in Boston here. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
We're well. What do you know, Nick?
Not much. The point I'd like to make here, you know, I'd have to disagree with everybody that we heard today. I mean, I don't think happiness is, you know, in a pill or in a psychology classroom or being taught at a class or anything like that. The only way to happiness is Christ. And, you know, as long as people don't have him, they're not going to be happy no matter what they do.
So religious faith has worked for you. What does that mean in your view, Nick? Does that mean a Buddhist can never be happy?
I would have to say yes. I mean, the Bible tells us, you know, if it ain't about Christ crucified at Calvary, it ain't of God, it's of the devil. And, you know, happiness is not going to come to anybody who wants to reject him and not accept him.
That's a pretty stern prescription for a bunch of the world, but we hear it, Nick. Todd, what about it?
Tom, can I take this one, Tom?
DT, sure. Religion, Nick says it's Jesus Christ or forget it, you're in trouble.
I'm really glad this came up. There's a lot of studies that show that if you're religious, doesn't matter what denomination, people report being extremely happy compared to atheists. But here's the interesting thing. So we can stop there and we can say to ourselves, hey, here's the cure for making people happy in a happier society. But I'm going to go to Richard Feynman, who says that we need to sort of bend over backwards to try and disprove our theories, which is something psychology doesn't do a good enough job at. And let me just suggest a really compelling alternative hypothesis that hasn't been ever tested yet empirically.
Okay.
And that's the idea of if you look at atheists, this is not a homogenous group. So if you look at Nobel laureates, the vast majority are atheists. If you look at sort of the National Academy of Science, over 90% of members are atheists. These are people who have a lot of purpose in life, but they're not religious. An interesting, compelling hypothesis is that it's not necessarily whether or not you're religious that makes you happy, but by having a strong sense of purpose in life that serves as a framework for your decisions, your behaviors, and your goals. This isn't just intellectual fluff, because if the evidence leans towards that direction, we're talking about a very different type of intervention. Of do we just give kids a religion, have them pick sort of a personal God for them to believe in, or do we cultivate to clarify their values and develop a sense of purpose in whatever endeavor it is? It would lead to two very different interventions. And the thing is right now there's a tendency to see as religion is a route to well-being and going what was sort of Caroline was talking about before. That's just correlational at the present point. So I'm at the same time as a researcher, I'm as big of a skeptic as anyone else out there.
And there we go. With that, we're just about out of time here. Caroline Keating, faith or commitment as the bigger path, in your view?
I think it's a lot about self-concept and identity, and identifying with something that's larger than oneself does have positive benefits for people.
It may be faith, and it may be work. It's been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank all three of you. Caroline Keating at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
Todd Kashtan at George Mason University. Todd, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
And DT Max with the New York Times. DT, thanks for being here.
I enjoyed myself.
I'm happy to hear it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.